Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series in order to bring energy to the public dialogue that's taking place by asking what I think is the critical question and examining it from every possible perspective. And that question is, how can awakening, higher consciousness and practice play a role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges, to make it as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable presence on our planet? So this is a part of a remarkable series of conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. And today I'm excited to be joined by Kenneth Folk, and we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled, Awakening is Possible, But So What? A Pragmatic Approach to Intersubjective Awakening. So the way this will work is I'll introduce Kenneth and we'll spend about an hour in dialogue and then I'll make some announcements. And at the end, we'll spend the last half hour or so taking your questions. So I expect we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Kenneth Folk first came to my attention because he was one of the most intelligent and creative participants in the active creation of pragmatic Dharma approaches, as chronicled on Buddhist Geeks, including intersubjective meditation practices. Right now, mindfulness is gaining mainstream acceptance intellectually through the confluence of Buddhism, neuroscience, and psychotherapy, and culturally through the even cultural and corporate embrace of it, especially in the tech world. We see that in Wisdom 2.0, Google Search Inside Yourself, recent article in Wired Magazine quotes Kenneth, in fact. Much of that movement, though, in my opinion, simply popularizes beginning practices. It is pragmatic and stays away from anything that seems mystical or new agey. But there's another pragmatic stream that's fiercely rational and agnostic and also rigorously avoids metaphysical presumptions. But I think it's much more advanced and interesting. And this is grounded in deeper, sustained meditative practice and is experimenting and improvising and actively evolving Dharma in ways that I think are important for everyone to know more about. And I see Kenneth as one of the most interesting voices in this increasingly influential growing edge of evolving Dharma. He began practicing Buddhist meditation in 1980. He's trained extensively in the Mahasi Theravada Buddhist tradition in Southeast Asia and the United States. His main teachers were Bill Hamilton, Sayadaw Pandita, and Sayadaw Kundala. In 2004, Kenneth experienced a fundamental shift in consciousness, finding a happiness that is not dependent on conditions, and ending his lifelong struggle with depression. Since that time, he has devoted his life to helping others realize this same peace of mind. He's known for combining different contemplative approaches in clear and accessible ways for his innovative and highly effective techniques and for the success of his students. In my readings of his writings and in our conversation, what I've most appreciated is Kenneth's clarity, intelligence, and curiosity, his willingness to engage in open-ended inquiry and to not know, and his modesty but seriousness about actual practice and the evolution of practice and Dharma. So welcome, Kenneth. It's a real pleasure to have you with me on this program today.
Thank you, Terry. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, cool. Well, let's start with this provocative title. Awakening is Possible is the first piece of that. So, awakening is possible for everyone. How do you know? What can you say about that? And what can you say to make what you mean by awakening more meaningful and clear to someone who's just encountering it for the first time?
When I read the early Buddhist texts, I have the impression that some of what I'm reading there is true. In other words, it actually happened, and I think some of it is accreted on through the centuries. The part that I believe is true is that a group of people, beginning with the historical Buddha, at least in his circle, in other words, there may have been people who were awake in other parts of the world and before him, but in this particular lineage, the Buddha was the first one to awaken, and then everybody around the Buddha started to wake up too, and they achieved these very high levels of awakening by their own standards. I think that is true, and because I believe that, and because I believe that human beings are still capable of doing what people 2,500 years ago were capable of doing, it follows that whatever awakening they were getting, we can get too. So that's kind of a beginning point. My definition for awakening, and I think this is consistent with some of the early Theravada Buddhist teachings, before the layers of hagiography and mythology, awakening is seeing experience as process in real time. It doesn't have anything to do, in my opinion, with being purified or saintly or holy. It's actually a way of perceiving. And this can be trained. There are very specific exercises that target this particular kind of human development. As human development, it also follows that it is available to most people. Now, I'm not going to say everybody, because some people have challenges in that regard. For example, if I have a stroke and half of my brain freezes up, it may be that whatever awakening I think I have goes away. And it may be that, in fact, I think that's very likely. And at the same time, if you come to this practice with some serious cognitive deficit, that may be a factor. But yes, I think it's possible for most people, and we know how to do it. So this pragmatism is at the very core of how I think about these things. Awakening is possible. I know because it happened to me, and it is ongoing. And my project is to share the practices and conceptual frameworks that lead to this awakening as I define it. Now, notice I completely dispense with what I call the cartoon saint version of enlightenment, the idea that you will become, that you will glow in the dark and have a 24/7 beatific smile and everybody will like you and you'll always behave impeccably by everyone's standards is not credible. It's ridiculous on the face of it, so I don't use that definition. This is an important definition to be explicit about. In other words, what do I mean when I say it? Because if people think that I mean the cartoon saint version, they can look at me and immediately see that I don't qualify. And I agree that I don't qualify. But that's not what I mean.
So then very specifically, there's an awareness and a residing as the observing awareness that is not fully identified with the stream of selfing. Even if that persists, there's a freedom from it fundamentally that changes one's relationship to experience profoundly and fundamentally.
I would say it a little bit differently. I think there is a point on a developmental continuum where we tend to identify as a kind of disembodied observer. But I think that also can be rolled back into the process so that even the momentarily arising sense of observer is just another function, just another process within the overall process, and so there isn't anywhere to stand whatsoever. There, in fact, I think one of the associated pathologies, if you will, with practice as I teach it, and my main way of teaching this is to ask people to objectify the subject, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But an associated pathology can be that you are always the observer, and you're kind of looking at your life through glass, and there's a bit of dissociation there. But that is actually resolved through the process, through the practice itself, because all experience can be objectified and spins back into the overall system. Metaphorically, it's as though you are experiencing yourself as a weather pattern. These things are happening, things are spinning around, it's raining over there and there's a tornado over here, but there isn't anybody in there that can stand aside from weather and dispassionately observe it. There isn't any mystical, metaphysical consciousness or awareness that somehow is immutable and sees this, at least not experientially. I mean, we can make up stories to explain this, but the experience of it is simply process, things moving all the time, and there doesn't seem to be anybody in here doing it, even though the momentarily arising sense, oh, this is happening to me, does certainly spin up within that weather pattern.
So the quality of experience simply is in a sense more transparent or flowing or centerless rather than removed with a kind of dispassionate painted glass between us and what's happening. And that would be, and it's that freedom from the identification with the fixed point of view of the so-called ego that is the shift.
Yes, yes. And what that allows for is what I think of as meta-okayness, so a kind of equanimity that is so robust that it can even allow for, frankly, suffering. It can allow for any experience whatsoever. And I consider this to be a more profound kind of experience, a more profound kind of awakening than, for example, an eradication model. So an eradication model would be, I'm going to develop to the point where I will never feel anger, anger will never arise. And I have a whole checklist of what I would consider to be negative or unwholesome mind states, and those will never arise if I get enlightened enough. Now, I have some problems with that. For one thing, I doubt that it has ever happened. I think we are, to anybody, to any human, I think we are constrained by our human biology and physiology and psychology, and these very deep-level processes happen. You know, fear and anger and agitation, to make an enemy out of those and then to make a fantasy goal of getting rid of those seems to me counterproductive and flying in the face of pragmatism. So for me, it's actually a worthier goal, a higher goal, if you will, to cultivate a kind of meta-okayness that allows for anger to arise, along with whatever else we would wish, we would hope doesn't arise. In other words, the things that I most...
Yeah, so-called negative states of mind and emotion, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, shame, intimidation, the things I really don't want to admit to.
Self-loathing, yeah, go for it.
Self-loathing. It happens. Yeah, it happens. And to allow that to happen, now that, for me, is freedom.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that this corresponds to some of the most radical texts, which more or less are even those texts that rested upon this very thorough decades-long purification of the body-mind that did eliminate various negative states of mind and emotion. Eventually, they said the highest realization was one that was free then to coexist with changing states of mind and emotion, even negative ones. So the bypassing of the decades of purification seems like something that many people in this time are saying, well, you know, let's respect and honor that a certain kind of purification of the body and mind might have some utility. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but putting that between us and freedom is crazy.
Beautiful. Yes,
yeah.
this kind of meta-okayness that we're talking about has the virtue of being doable, and I have seen it happen enough times to be convinced that it's reproducible for most people if they're willing to do the work that it takes.
And you do that via a very specific process that I've looked at on your website. I think it might be good to introduce that. I'm happy to go through it. You can guide me into the essence of it if you think that would be helpful as a way of making it visible and transparent to everyone listening.
Good. Okay, so the basic framework for the teaching itself is the three-speed transmission, which is a little bit of a joke on the idea of transmission, but also on a car transmission where you can shift gears. The three-speed transmission evolved in response to my need to make sense of what seemed to be contradictory teachings within various traditions. For example, most of my formal training is in Mahasi Sayadaw Theravada Buddhism, where you do a lot of noting, a lot of mental noting, where you objectify the experience and give it a label. For example, if I do it in real time now, just calling out where my attention goes without my directing attention, here's what's happening for me: hearing, pressure, warmth, interest, engagement, excitement, agitation, dryness, aversion, amusement, self-deprecation, pride, joy, compassion. So those are just things that are coming up in the moment. And that's the practice. That's the noting practice as taught by Mahasi Sayadaw. At some point, I also was exposed to a category of practices that might be called non-dual practices. And so at its kind of most ruthless essence, the non-dual practice would be forget about it. Whatever, this moment is already here. This moment is already here. So whatever you thought you were going to do about this moment, it's too late. Give up the self-improvement project entirely. I think that phrase comes from Tulku Urgen or maybe his son Sokni Rinpoche. And there's also a lot of this kind of idea in Zen, so shikantaza, just sitting. Just sitting is actually the manifestation of awakeness, according to this idea. Now, this is a really elegant and simple and powerful idea, and as Zen people will be fond of pointing out, it doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't even work for most people, because just sitting and being distracted isn't what they're talking about. So what I've talked about so far are what I call first gear. First gear is includes the Mahasi style noting, and I've talked about third gear, so just sitting, forget about it, it's over, and also Mahamudra practices that involve looking toward the essential nature of mind. That would be a third gear practice. Second gear is self-inquiry. Who am I? So you see that in Wato, in Zen. Korean Zen does a lot of who am I type practice, and especially in Advaita Vedanta. So notice that I'm not I'm not such a Buddhist that I would say, oh, well, we must dismiss any practices that are not Buddhist. That makes no sense to me at all. From a pragmatic orientation, we should do whatever practices work. So it's my observation that all of those are really good practices. Noting Mahasi's style, self-inquiry, and just letting it be are respectively first, second, and third gear in my system. So once I started thinking of it that way and shifting between these gears as appropriate, I found that the triangulation from those different points of view was really powerful. So there's a synergy from looking at these things from different points of view. And it started to make sense to me. I didn't have to choose. I didn't have to say, oh, you Advaitists are fools. We Buddhists have the right answer. That's all meaningless to me now. And with the three-speed transmission, we can allow for just about any practice. We can fit it in there somewhere. And even the practices that don't seem to fit in well, still we get some perspective on them by having the system, by having the scaffold of the three-speed transmission. So in a nutshell, first gear asks what is happening. Second gear asks who, to whom is it happening? And third gear, forget about it, it's over. You're either enlightened or you're not, but you're not going to fix this.
And these gears are mastered sequentially over time. I would work primarily doing first gear for a while, and when it was stabilized, I'd introduce second. And when that was stabilized, I'd introduce third. Or are these all done from the beginning, at the very beginning of the practice as you teach it?
Great question. In practice, I find that most people do it sequentially. And not because I have a preference about that, but because that's how it's most accessible to them. Now, just because it's most easily learned in sequence does not mean it's a hierarchy of development. In other words, I used to think that there was a hierarchy and that what you were trying, that the goal was to move from first to second gear, which was actually a higher or better practice, and to third gear, which was a higher or better practice than that, and then somehow hang out all the time in some kind of a non-dual space of third gear. I no longer believe that. I find that the ontological privileging, in other words, saying that the true nature of mind, the essential nature of mind with a capital T or a capital E, is somehow known to us, that we should privilege the non-dual perspective over a dualistic perspective. I don't buy that anymore. And so really, all of these perspectives are just lenses through which we can experience, which we can view our own experience, if you want to be dualistic. Fine. And that is another great relief. That's another great freedom. Oh, you mean I don't have to be wrong every time I'm not having a non-dual experience? What a concept. I think it's human nature to kind of get into a can you top this kind of orientation. My way is better than your way. My guru can beat up your guru. My tradition is better than yours. I'm not buying any of that. But as a practical matter, triangulating from these three points of view as a practice is really effective at moving people through a developmental continuum that results in this meta-okayness that I'm advocating, and this ability to see experience as process in real time.
Now, you know, I first of all, you know, thank you. That was very, very lucid, and I think valuable for this. You know, it's a clear, useful foundation for this whole conversation. It does provoke me to want to circle back kind of to the original starting place for it, though, which is your definition of awakening, because it's controversial. I've already received a question from someone who's saying, wait a second, the title itself here is almost offensive. Awakening is possible, but so what? Awakening, real awakening, is the thing that makes the whole difference in the traditions. It's treated as rare and, you know, more or less world-shaking. And if you're demoting it to be something less than that, aren't you having a less interesting conversation? Isn't that profound and radical awakening the thing that can evoke, well, all of the higher human capacities of intelligence and creativity and courage and generosity and, you know, every positive virtue possible? And it isn't it that which evokes awe and devotional love and gratitude in the person awakening, and often even in those who experience the presence of that person? Doesn't it catalyze the highest aspirations and even the highest motivations of people? Hasn't it been this kind of exalted state of, and then, you know, others would say not merely a state, but using Ken Wilber's distinctions, a stage of development that actually enables people to operate on a whole different level, solve problems at a whole different level, relate to others at a whole different level, and be a constant source of kind of liberating love and freedom in a way that is, you know, profoundly transformational. And aren't you, by being very precise about your own experience and identifying something real that you're experiencing as awakening, are you perhaps looking away from something even more profound that everybody has talked about in the traditions and praised so highly? And are we having a conversation about something lesser and perhaps less interesting? That would be the challenge, I think.
Beautiful. Okay, this is great. So I'd like to respond to that by using two historical figures, one of which is certainly mythological, and the other one might be. Okay, so I want to talk about the Buddha and Hercules. So addressing the question, isn't it rare, this thing that we're talking about is awakening? Well, not according to the early Buddhist texts. It's not rare at all, and it's not particularly difficult to achieve for those who work very hard to achieve it. And the reason I say so is because if you look at the Pali Suttas, the people around the Buddha were popping like popcorn, becoming arahats. There are numbers bandied about in some of the suttas. There were thousands of arahats. There are stories where somebody went to a monastery and got kind of kicked downstairs in seniority through all the arahats. He was looking for a teacher. It was Potila, the story of empty Potila. And he finally got kicked down to a 7-year-old arahat who was the lowest arahat on the totem pole among hundreds. Now, granted, hyperbole can certainly enter into these stories as they're passed through time, but if you believe that, if you believe kind of the essence of Buddhism, that the Buddha said, "I am awake," and then he spent 30 years or 50 years, whatever, teaching other people to awaken, and they did awaken. Well, rarity is not the problem. It isn't rare. Now, I'll address why we tend to think of it as being rare now by talking about Hercules. Once you have a story of a great hero, it's natural to kind of layer on, can you top this kind of stories? oh, you think your teacher is pretty good? Well, my teacher can do this. And there actually is that. You can find that in the suttas. Oh, your teacher can sit for an hour without noticing as an army walks by. That's nothing. My teacher can sit by for an hour undisturbed while elephants trumpet nearby. So you're going to have this kind of can you top this storytelling. Let's look at the myth of Hercules, who was almost infinitely strong and invincible. We do not train modern athletes by referring to the myth of Hercules. We don't say, okay, we know that it's really rare, and actually we don't know anybody who's ever done it, and okay, let's face it, you're not going to become Hercules. But still, it's really beneficial for you as an athlete in training to have this image of perfection that you can aspire to in this kind of romantic way. And why don't we? Why don't we do that? And I would submit that we don't because it doesn't work. It's not effective for actually training athletes to excellence. If it were, I think every elite athletic training program in the world would use that, and they don't. What do they do instead? They talk about what is actually observable, what is really happening with real athletes, and they look for incremental improvements over time, always taking into account the constraints of human physiology and psychology. I submit that we will have better results, and that we're already having better results by giving up the myth of Hercules and the myth of a perfected enlightened saint and talking about what really happens.
Well, I feel that although there is a stream of taking that line of inquiry deeper that I know some of my listeners probably want me to engage with you, that you've really done a great job of answering the essences of it, and that the more fruitful direction for us to go is to take a look then on the basis of this at some of the dispositional anchors that have guided your whole process, which seem to me to be empirical, agnostic, pragmatic. You're willing to doubt and throw away lots of what you're, I think, considering the mystical accretions of the traditions in order to focus attention on what is real and what is transmissible to your students in a way that's, you know, replicable. And in a way, it seems to me that you're bringing very rational and even scientific orientation to the whole process. Can you step back and meta comment on the disposition you're bringing? Because it seems to me that that's informing everything that you're saying in a way that deserves to be called out and looked at.
Yes. My basic orientation is kind of ruthlessly unsentimental. I will risk offending people even more by saying that if I didn't find the teachings of the Buddha helpful, I would just dispense with the Buddha entirely. I'm not married to thinking of myself as a Buddhist. I, as it happens, I do find those teachings very helpful, and at this point, it's the most effective teaching that I can do. Often does use Buddhist concepts and refer to Buddhism, but I'm willing to toss anything out. Now there's another metaphor here that I think is really really to the point, and a friend and student of mine several years ago pointed this out to me, that there's a relationship or there's a similarity between pragmatic Dharma, as we're seeing it evolve, and mixed martial arts. When I was a kid, we used to have schoolyard debates. We would say Bruce Lee could beat up, he was a kung fu guy, his own kind of kung fu Jeet Kune Do, and Bruce Lee could beat up Chuck Norris, who was a hard karate guy, Japanese karate. And by the way, we already know that because that's what happened in the movie Enter the Dragon. We saw Bruce Lee beat up Chuck. But in any case, we would have these discussions about which of the pure traditional martial arts styles was best. And you could toss anything into the mix there. You could say, no, a boxer would win, or a wrestler would win. So this was speculation for a long time. But at some point, this might have been probably in the late 80s, 90s, a group of people formed the Ultimate Fighting Championships to answer this question in a very pragmatic way, by putting people from different traditions in a ring, in a cage, and letting them fight. Now, this was put together by people who were advocates of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and so they actually wanted to prove that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was the best form of martial arts. And initially, they did really well with that particular style. But over time, what emerged was there wasn't any single pure style that would consistently prevail. And more, everybody had to identify the holes in their own game and cross-train to plug those holes. So let's say you were purely a ground fighter. Your whole approach is to knock people down and choke them out or make them submit in some way. And you're fighting a person who is just a boxer. He doesn't know anything about being on the ground. Well, a couple of things can happen. For one thing, you're just a ground fighter. You don't know how to box. You get knocked out immediately. On the other hand, if you are lucky and you manage to survive for a few seconds and get in and grab a hold of the boxer as the ground fighter, you can take him down or take her down and choke that person out. But the really effective mixed martial artist is going to be good at stand-up meaning boxing, for example, or kickboxing, and ground fighting. So an entirely new sport emerged. Anything that didn't work in the octagon, as they call the cage, whatever doesn't work in the octagon, forget about it. You just dispense with it instantly. So you have a very rapid evolution of the sport. And the new sport emerges, mixed martial arts, where you have people who are very well-rounded in all these aspects of fighting. Interesting, something emergent here that we wouldn't have anticipated. And if we had stuck with our narrow schools, kung fu guys only do kung fu with other kung fu guys, and karate gals only do karate with other karate women, we got something by putting this together. This is what's happening in pragmatic Dharma. So we for some years now, we've been getting together online with full disclosure, which is one of my one of the things that I advocate. Just tell the truth, you know. Forget about the taboos. Oh, you must never speak about what is happening to you. Why not? Come on, we're talking about human development, so let's just be honest. As a result of that kind of open discussion, we're learning. People share their experience, and we would even stand on our metaphorical mountaintops and say, "I'm the most enlightened person in town," and the other person would say, "No, it's me," and we would duke it out in our discussions, and everybody would learn something from it. For one thing, one of the things I learned is that that is a silly discussion in and of itself, that there is one way to be awakened, and I know what it is, and I am the apotheosis of human development. That is also debunked through this process of emerging the new sport, if you will, of of pragmatic dharma, because what you see is that there are many ways to be excellent. There are, just as there are a dozen, 100, 1,000 ways to be excellent in sports, there are 1,000, 10,000 ways to be excellent in contemplative practice. So now we have this larger field of contemplative fitness, as I think of it, and lots of specialties in it. And yes, we can choose metrics for success, and we can even compete. Competition is not off the table. But we don't have to think of it as a convergence model where I call this pernicious convergence. It's kind of a joke, but pernicious convergence says that there is one way to be enlightened, and I know what that is, and I'll just point to my favorite guru. You know, everybody does this. Okay, my favorite guru was enlightened, and everyone else was a failed version of that person. Now, we don't allow for that kind of, we don't tolerate that kind of unsophisticated argument in most arenas of human development. We see that there are so many different ways to be excellent, but we still fall for that kind of thing in our spiritual thinking and our spiritual discussions. And I'm looking to a time where we're the center of gravity of culture, of contemplative culture, moves beyond that to a more sophisticated understanding that there isn't only one way to do this, and it's not a question of whose guru can beat up whose guru.
Great. Now, maybe rather briefly, but it's just too interesting not to ask these questions. Can you enumerate a few of the kinds of excellence that show up and some of the metrics that seem useful as you engage this pragmatic dharmic approach?
Yes. Okay, so one very clear metric would be aptitude with altered states. Now, this is not my favorite metric, and I think that ultimately one needs to kind of go beyond it and use it as a scaffold for something else. But certainly you could say, as some people do, Pao Auk Sayadaw, for example, a Theravada Buddhist monk, very, very elderly, or what's the word, elderly, very senior, and revered Buddhist monk from Burma, teaches jhana practice. So jhanas are altered states of absorption that are very clearly defined and reproducible. So for him, you must be able to enter this state and stay in it, completely absorbed without discursive thought for 2 hours. I think that's the metric. I haven't practiced with him, but this is what I've heard. If you can do that, he will grant that you have attained to that particular jhana, that particular state. Now, that's a really clear metric for success, and I appreciate that kind of clarity. So that is one kind of excellence. And it would be hard to deny that that is a remarkable manifestation of human excellence. In a way, not to be too dismissive of human excellence in this particular aspect, but this ties back into our question, so what? So there's a so what here. All right, you can put yourself in an exquisitely pleasant and subtle state, essentially purify your consciousness, if you will, for 2 hours straight, and so what? At the end of that, you have your 2 hours closer to death, as far as I can tell. Now, if you can use that power of mind to remain stable and undistracted while you then investigate the experience, while you investigate the objects of consciousness as they arise, or the objects of attention, then you'd be doing vipassana as opposed to samatha. Samatha is the Pali word for shamatha, meaning, which is the Sanskrit word, meaning concentration practice. If you can use that as a platform, then now you've really got something. And that is how it's often taught. So it's not as though Pao Erk Saito doesn't know this. It's just that he spends a lot of time with his people building that scaffold of bulletproof concentration, and then, as I would say it, vipassanize that to get insight to do what? Well, to come to this, to my favorite metric for excellence, which is the ability to see experience as process. So those are two metrics for success.
Okay, great. Which brings us really to the place I wanted to land in this conversation, which is the so what. Clearly, seeing experience as process liberates one from all kinds of arbitrary stucknesses, sort of subtle internal ways of being dogmatic or sentimentally attached to points of view that limit your ability to actually observe and flow and creatively relate to experience. And I am imagining that the so what for you is answered by the functional excellence that is possible when there is that liberation of attention from those kinds of stucknesses, and that this might confer an ability to not just function better within the existing frame, but to re-examine the presumptions that create that frame and to be both creative and meta-creative, and maybe intersubjectively meta-creative. Is that where you go with this?
Yes. Yes. So the way I would say this, so what? All right. So we get to my favorite metric for contemplative excellence, seeing experience as process. Now, by the way, I will argue that this is actually better than being a cartoon saint. That the richness of having the full spectrum of experience and being okay with that, so this meta-okayness, is actually subjectively better, more desirable than being a cartoon saint who just smiles all the time and has a wonderful time. So having said that, we're still talking about, so far, subjective experience. And one way to, that I think beautifully encompass this in a concept is by using Ken Wilber's four quadrants. So if I were to quickly recap summarize the four quadrants, upper left is my subjective experience, upper right is my behavior, lower left is collective, it's culture, essentially, so shared beliefs. And lower right is institutions. So this is, as a collective, our behavior. Now, meditation, as it's often taught in any kind of spiritual practice, tends to dramatically emphasize the upper left, the subjective experience, so much so that you will hear even great teachers, you can even find, you can interpret the Buddha quotes as saying this. This is all that matters. Your experience of the world, that's everything. And so if you can get your experience together, the whole world will, I don't know, it would be fine, it will all work out. And I say bullshit. I think all four of those quadrants are important, and I think that was Ken Wilber's point in graphing it that way. And to introduce a thought experiment here, I can ask myself, all right, Kenneth, with your vaunted expertise in subjective experience, so I think I'm a big shot here. are you somehow more valuable, more important than Thomas Jefferson? Now, Thomas Jefferson, as far as I know, he may not have had any great depth in the subjective contemplative practice department, and yet, in the area of culture, so lower left quadrant now, which resulted from his personal behavior, his exterior behavior, which is upper right in the quadrant, and especially at the level of institutions. Lower right, so influencing our system of government, the impact that Thomas Jefferson had on the world was so profound that for me to even put myself in that discussion is laughable. Of course I'm not more important than Thomas Jefferson. So it shows me very, very clearly it isn't true that my subjective experience trumps everything. And once I let that in, now, by the way, this is a very difficult thing to let in for meditators, because we, pretty early in our career as diehard meditators, become identified as yogis, as meditators, and we believe we tread the moral high ground. So we will tend to dismiss people who are working at the level of behavior, culture, and institutions as, oh, it's okay for them to play their little games, but really it's all about personal awakening. But once we can see the fallacy of that and understand that the rest of the world matters, that your relationships matter, and that culture matters, and that the world matters, there's a death of innocence and a coming of age and a grieving process as you allow that load-bearing pillar of identity to fall. And then there's more freedom. Oh, okay then. I don't have to hide anymore in my cave, literal or metaphorical. And I don't have to pretend that I tread the moral high ground anymore. That's a relief. So now we can start talking about intersubjective awakening. And I'm going to just
get please. Back I was going to ask you to go there next anyway. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay. We know from Buddhist theory that it isn't going to be possible to find anybody in here. So at the individual level, it is going to be. We can't find anybody in here. Now, the Buddha was pretty good about not making ontological claims, so he would shy away from saying there absolutely is no self. He would just say you're not going to find it. And those of us who do this practice consistently, this may be the only thing that there's consensus on in the world, we consistently find that we cannot find anybody in here, anybody at the center of this experience. So what the hell are we talking about when we say, I'm going to get enlightened? That completely would seem to fly in the face of this assumption that we had going in and that we keep validating constantly, that there's nobody in here. The truth is, both of those points of view work fine. It does work if a person says, I'm going to have a goal to awaken, and I'm going to do the practices that are shown to lead to that. And at some point, I'm going to say, wow, you know, I got what I came for. There isn't anybody in here. And even though I'm saying I as a convention, because that's how we communicate, it's clear in any given moment to be seen that there isn't anyone in here. So fine, it's a false dichotomy. But given the fact that there isn't anybody in here to wake up, I would say it's just as reasonable to say that a relationship can awaken. Well, there isn't anybody in there either, but there's something going on. There's a process. There's an individual process. There's a relationship process. That relationship can awaken, and culture can awaken. So what do I mean by this? Well, I'm talking about being able to see process. This happens at a very at a minute level, at a micro level, and it happens at a a more conceptual level as well, where we can reflect upon ourselves as a culture. I would argue that this has happened, that we can see the evolution of culture. So, for example, I'm reading a historical or semi-historical novel currently, and it's set in England and continental Europe in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. So one of the things that happens a lot is public hanging day. So every month or so, there's a public hanging day, and everybody troops into town for the good family entertainment of watching the hangings. Now, this is something that we don't do anymore. Most people in modern industrial society find that abhorrent. Now, how did that change come about? I will argue that it's a good thing that it changed that way. At least it's consistent with my values. How did it come about? Well, I think it came about through reflection. I think if you had to ask somebody in the late 17th century to kind of reflect on whether it's even a good idea to have public hangings as family entertainment, it's likely that they were so embedded in that, and this is using Ken Wilber's terminology here, so embedded in that culture, in that lens, that they wouldn't have been able to effectively reflect on it. But somehow, over the years, people talking to one another, it has changed. We are disembedding from some of our collective behaviors enough to change them. And I think that change can sometimes come quite naturally through the reflection itself. Now, at this point, I'd like to introduce a concept that I find really, really powerful. And this is Robert Keegan's kind of elegant formulation of how to move through the levels of developmental psychology, adult development, becoming more complex at each level in how you relate to your experience. In its simplest form, Keegan says objectify the subject. And this has to do with filters, with lenses. If there's a filter over my experience that I cannot see as a filter, so let's say it's a blue thin plastic filter it's strapped to my face. Well, every place I look, it's blue. I'm completely embedded in blue. I'm embedded as blue. I think I'm blue. I'm identified as blue. But the minute I can peel that away enough, or intersubjectively, maybe somebody can point out to me, you know, there's a blue filter stuck to your face. As soon as I can see that there's a filter and start to objectify it, something changes completely. Now it's out there. This filter can be objectified and manipulated as an object, and although it can still be used and may spontaneously arise as a filter, you can see that in real time. You can say, oh, I'm looking through the blue filter. That's why everything looks blue. Now, that's a kind of awakening and a kind of freedom. That very simple model, objectify the subject, because whatever filter you're not seeing, is functioning as subject. That simple model explains so much. I think it explains not only why developmental psychology works in Keegan's map, I think it also explains why meditative awakening, what I think of as developmental awakening or developmental meditation, that's why that works. And it's probably why psychotherapy works. This disembedding, objectifying whatever is functioning as subject to the extent that that's possible, this is really powerful stuff. And we can do this for each other in relationship. We can kind of enlighten, we can awaken this space, this intersubjective space between two people or between a group of people or culturally. So it becomes a really practical matter of taking all the skills that we develop as meditators to become master objectifiers and applying those to the intersubjective space.
And you're doing this with your students. I mean, you have a number of interesting techniques. Some of them involve working in dyads. Some of them break forth beyond mere dyads. And you have some sense, I guess, that these experiments are something that can generalize among groups of leaders. It's unlikely that they're going to generalize across a whole culture, but they might generalize to a broad enough swath of people at a high enough level of influence that they could change the direction of the way that that culture shapes and reforms and revises its systems and institutions such that it could have an effect on the whole.
Yes, that's an emphatic yes. I believe that once this becomes a cultural value, which, by the way, in and of itself would be a manifestation of what we're talking about, where a concept emerges, kind of carving out the conceptual space out of nothing, and you place a concept in there, oh, there's intersubjective awakening, which, of course, I didn't invent. There have been some people working on this for some time now, and it's a fascinating idea. And this ability to the ability of intersubjective awakening, or maybe in less lofty terms, intersubjective growth or development, its ability to influence culture and through culture institutions, I really would like to see that systemized. I would like to see more people understanding that it can be done, that there are techniques, the simple Mahasi noting technique that I demonstrated earlier, where I just label and call out my experience, well, that can be done with two people. So I have adapted the silent Mahasi noting to do it aloud, and once you're doing it aloud, you might as well do it in a dyad or in a group. And so you can ping-pong it back and forth. I say seeing, you say hearing, I say excitement, you say uncertainty. I mean, we're going to call out our experience. This is a remarkably powerful tool, both for developmental awakening and for developmental psychology and for this intersubjective development we're talking about, because you're not only getting it out there, you're not only objectifying it by saying it, you're noticing it, you're saying it, somebody else is hearing it. Somebody else is in some cases, responding to it. And so this, I think this should be done. And one of the things I'm working on now is to bring this idea of intersubjective meditation to a wider audience. And as you say, getting groups of leaders together to be able to reflect back to each other what they're missing. So this question, what is the filter? What am I missing? What's flying beneath the radar? These are the questions we need to be asking.
Yeah, that's the crux of it right there. Yeah.
Yes. And if you can get with a group of people who share that value and have the explicit goal to show each other what they're missing. I mean, the curvature of the earth is very difficult to see when you're standing on it. But somebody else who's standing far enough away looking at you can see you and the curvature of the earth and reflect that back to you. The process of growth here can be really accelerated at the dyad level and at the group level. I participate in a group here in San Francisco that we call the Intersubjective Incubator. And we have all been very pleasantly surprised, and in fact, that's understating the case. We've all been kind of gobsmacked by how much we have grown and how much we can see the others grow just by getting together to let something emerge, to be willing to let go of our agenda, to school other people on how it is, and to find out what happens when we all get together and talk, and be open to the possibility that somebody will show us what we're missing.
So that there are some ground rules for that kind of investigation, and I'd like to get into that as soon as we come back, but I can't delay any longer. We do need to open this up for listeners. So if you have any questions for Kenneth or me, please, if you're listening by phone, raise your hand by pressing star 2 on your telephone keypad, or if you're listening online using your computer, just type your question into the instant teleseminar window. Now, first, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Kenneth's work. He blogs about meditation and awakening at kennethfolkdharma.com, kennethfolkdharma.com. So you can sign up for his mailing list there, and you can be informed about upcoming events and new writings and teachings. He also trains meditators in one-on-one sessions via live video. And you can find out more about that at popexpert.com, popexpert.com/Kenneth Folk. You're also invited to follow him on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the keyword Kenneth Folk. I also want you to be aware of my work. Even if you're on the mailing list for Beyond Awakening, you're not necessarily on my personal mailing list, which is at terrypatton.com. I invite you to go there and sign up. There are some opportunities to work with me coming up soon, towards the end of this month, September 27th through 29th. I'll be at Esalen Institute in Big Sur, leading a retreat called Encountering the Beloved, Integral Practice to Liberate Your Soul. It'll be an intimate process of experiential self-inquiry and transformational learning to explore authentic intimacy with the living divine reality. I'll be incorporating interpersonal processes, journaling, meditation, prayer, movement, nature communion, and celebration. And as you know, Esalen is justly famous and wonderful place to restore yourself. October 31st through November 3rd, I'll be co-hosting the Integral Living Room in Boulder, Colorado with Diane Musho-Hamilton, Jeff Salzman, and Ken Wilber. It has sold out, but you can get on the waiting list at integrallivingroom.com. You can find out about all these events at terrypatton.com and working with me individually and, of course, getting on my mailing list, as I said. So let's go take a look at what has arrived in the way of new questions. Well, before we get right into those, Kenneth, could you respond to the question I posed immediately before the break? Which was, you were talking about what was going on in the intersubjective group and how gobsmacked you were, and I was kind of prodding you to speak maybe more anecdotally to illustrate and make concrete what you're talking about how this the agreements, the assumptions, the rules of the road that make that kind of profound process possible, and perhaps the kinds of participants, you know, there may be some qualifications or minimum standards of adequacy for the kind of thing you're doing as well.
This particular group is mediated by a woman named Terry Hinton, and she has a particular gift for I don't want to say mediated, that's not the right word. It's curated. So Terry chooses who participates in the group, and she has a special feel for people who are likely to both be receptive to this kind of exploration and be able to embody or represent a particular meme which would gel and enhance the overall discussion. So the ground rules are mostly no rules, so it's pretty wide open. But the understanding is that We're not there to pound the pulpit. So if you get on a soapbox, and all of us have done this from time to time, so somebody will bring some really juicy idea and hold forth passionately about that. The other people in the group will usually humorously point out to you that you're doing it. So one of the women in the group pointed out that each of us has some predictable thing that we're going to say. It's almost like you could have a little bobblehead doll for each of us and pull a string, and the doll would say something, some one-liner. Well, the people in the group don't want to hear your one-liner because they've already heard it so many times. So it's frowned upon that you're going to lecture the group. So the idea is you come together and you just start talking. We usually don't even have an agenda anymore. We don't even take agenda points at the beginning of the meeting. We just sit there and somebody will say something, and we'll riff on that to something else. Now, everybody in the group shares on some level an interest in awakening at the personal and especially at the intersubjective level.
And is the point awakening, or is the point innovative new ideas that somehow move culture forward? And you're along the lines of your analogy about the greater importance of Thomas Jefferson.
Beautiful. You're right, and when I say awakening, that's my bobblehead, right? That's if you pull my string, I'm going to say awakening, awakening. Other people in the group wouldn't have that at all. So you're right. It's more about innovative ideas that would move culture forward, as you say. And there's a lot of sober acknowledgement that we may not move culture forward. I mean, in a sense, it's a very grandiose idea, and so we laugh at ourselves about this. We are going to influence culture. Look at us. We're not sure whether we'll have any effect at all, but we certainly can see the growth within the group. And within the individuals of the group. And you asked for specifics about that. So what can I say about myself and my own group here, or my own growth, rather? Since I've been participating in the intersubjective incubator, which has been almost 2 years, some of my notions, some of the things I thought I knew have come into question. There isn't very much anymore that I feel comfortable holding on to. I know what awakening is and everybody else is wrong, that sort of thing. I would hold that much more loosely now. I think my own ability to switch among and between lenses and filters has grown a lot. I think I'm becoming more complex in how I relate to my environment. And I consider that to be a good thing. So that would be consistent with Robert Keegan's map of how we move up the levels of developmental psychology. We become more complex.
Excellent. Let me turn to a listener question. Maya in Isla Vista asks, I find Kenneth's approach refreshing and helpful, but I want to ask what his everyday awakening experience is like, specifically, in detailed language rather than generally. What capacities manifest now that did not before, not only emotionally, but in all realms of experience?
Not only emotionally, but in all realms of experience. Well, That's going to be difficult because it's so broad. And the first thing that came to mind was something emotional. So I guess I better just run with that. Specifically, one of the things that's changed for me is that I don't get depressed anymore. There was a time, right up until a time being my entire adult life, up until summer of 2004, where I was subject to crippling bouts of depression. What would happen is I would wake up one day and a kind of black. I've noticed there would be a kind of black despair. I would think of this now as a dark filter. And when I would notice that, I would immediately become afraid, I'm terrified, really, because, oh no, I've seen where this goes. Whenever I have this kind of despair, it reinforces itself and spirals into dysfunction, which might last weeks or maybe even months. And during that time, I'm likely to be really, really unhappy to the point where I would consider death, the surcease of death, to be a real blessing. So that up until that summer of 2004, I wasn't able to do anything about that downward spiral. I saw it coming, I knew it was coming, and it came. After that time, and this coincided with a particular shift in my practice, the filter might still come. So there would be this moment. Oh, here's this despair, but it did not spiral out of control. There was the objectification of it. Okay, this is a filter. I think even as early as 2004 and before that, I was thinking in terms of these filters. But at that point, it was objectified well enough that it didn't take hold and start this this deadly cycle of depression. So I haven't been depressed since then. I stopped taking weaned off of my SSRI antidepressant medication and my anti-anxiety medication under the supervision of my doctor, and realized I didn't need those medicines anymore because depression was no longer an issue. So that's just one example of how my life has improved. I could probably say something about my daily experience. I probably have the entire range of experiences that I've always had. I can have joy and compassion and metta, and of course we congratulate ourselves for having those things, but I can also have shame and self-loathing, as you mentioned earlier, and feeling intimidated and fear. But there's a big difference in how I experience it now from how I experienced it earlier in my life, and that is the experience comes and then it goes away, and there isn't this secondary judgment. There isn't the aversion to the aversion to the aversion. So that's something I remember writing about years ago when I started doing Vipassana, and I could see these things happening. I would remark upon the fact that I had this stacked aversion. I just got angry. I'm not supposed to get angry. I'm a good Buddhist meditator. Now I feel aversion to having been angry. Now I feel shame about being angry. Now I feel foolish for all. So that's what doesn't happen. The primary phenomenon comes and then it goes. And I think that's a big part of what this metta okayness that I'm talking about is. And stuff comes and it goes, including the momentarily rising sense that it's happening to me, and it's flowing. So flowing is a big part of it.
You know, as I hear you describe this, Kenneth, I find myself wondering about something. you know, one of Ken Wilber's other primary distinctions in addition to quadrants is types, and there are different types of many things, you know, types of weather, types of systems, but particularly there are personality types. And you strike me as being a very, you know, kind of intelligent, rational type, and therefore in some sense kind of a cooler type. And your description of your experience is, you know, the description of somebody whose capacity to observe and discern, you know, is one of the, you know, primary foci of how you seem to, you know, your MO as you flow through life. And this awakening, this description of awakening, you know, is mostly in terms that speak to that aspect of me. But there are all kinds of qualities of life, in particularly emphasized in other types, that are hotter, sexier, more passionate, more playful, more humorous, more about feeling textures, more about qualities of spontaneity and flow, less necessarily about discernment and focused, you know, at the head. And you might even say that there are certainly traditions for talking about awakening being a psychophysical affair that enlists the whole body and isn't necessarily particularly centered at the head center of the body. So I can kind of imagine a critique of what you're describing as awakening suggesting, you know, a focus on an aspect of awakening, maybe having all kinds of legitimacy, but not speaking to these other typological or whole bodily kinds of aspects of what might be possible in terms of higher states or stages of awareness. What do you say to that challenge?
I would say, first of all, that my kind of umbrella concept of contemplative fitness would certainly allow for these kinds of specialties. So somebody might be emphasizing this discernment aspect, and somebody else, Jack Kornfield, for example, comes to mind. He talks about heart, you know, so much that heart seems to be part of his branding now. You can't see anything from him that doesn't have the word heart, but he's not making it up. That's his experience of his awakening. And somebody might talk about some kind of unbridled passion and love that they particularly emphasize. So I would see all of those as being kind of sports within the contemplative fitness world, just because I'm borrowing the physical fitness schema. Of course, we're not really talking about sports. We're talking about a different kind of development, but certainly specialties. And yes, your personality type is going to have a great deal of influence over how you manifest your development, and I would add how you talk about it. So I might also add that if you and I had taken a different direction in this talk, I could have talked for on and on about Kundalini energy as experienced in this body, and psychic powers and my experience with those sorts of things. So to some extent, what you're talking about is a function of our dynamic. To a large extent, it is a function of my personality, and my type is, as you said, and I think to a large extent it's a function of my limitations as a communicator. So I would push back a little bit about being characterized as entirely heady, although I understand that I do that well. Yeah, so that's some thoughts about it.
Okay, well, that's great. That's really provocative. And I do want to move on to another question, but before I do, that was just too tempting. Maybe it's not appropriate for you to go on and on and on about them, but for you to say at least something basic and, you know, communicative about your experience of Kundalini and psychic abilities, I think would be really helpful to everyone on the call.
Well, from very early on in my Vipassana practice, and even for the 8 years that I was just doing simple kind of breath following meditation before I met Bill Hamilton and started doing Buddhist Vipassana practice, I was having these visceral body experiences of I would be meditating and I might have shaking or my eyes rolling up into my head or trembling afterward or very clear, sharp phantom pain somewhere in the body. And in fact, my first experience of anything that I would think of as my very own mystical experience was in 1982, where I aided by LSD and meditating, I had an experience of feeling as though I were pulled up into the sky through a glass tube, and had some kind of fascinating adventures on the way, and then was thrust out into this blinding white light and merged with that in an experience that I thought of at the time as merger with Godhead, the way Meister Eckhart might talk about those things. That was an experience that profoundly affected me. One of the things that happened as a result, apparently, because the very next day, my cocaine addiction, which I had been struggling with for a couple of years, vanished. I just never wanted to take cocaine again. But I think even without that kind of external validation, the subjective experience of that was so rich and profound that's what set me on the course to meditate. And initially, I just wanted to get that kind of God union back, that merger with the cosmos or the divine. I came to understand through my Buddhist training that that was not the be-all, end-all of human experience, but actually a fairly early signpost on a developmental continuum. So the kind of deeply emotional experiences and very heavily body-centric experience have been a big part of my development.
Hmm. And do you feel that, like, is it your experience that when the ability to notice the filters is freer, there is some native, non-ordinary psychic capacity that is more readily available to you and probably to everyone?
I think it is. It's definitely a result of training the mind, but I think it has more to do with training in concentration. So when the mind becomes very focused, it's possible to access altered states and to have what might be called I think might be accurately called psychic experiences. But these are subjective experiences, so there actually is a lot more we could say about that, and I know we don't have time for it, but I think some people make a little bit of a category mistake there, that because they're having a very clear and very very poignant and profound subjective experience of an altered state, and by the way, altered realms populated with beings who seem just as real as the ones here, they believe that that can kind of translate straight across into what you might call our normal waking reality. And I don't see it that way at all. And in fact, I would say that just as Stephen Hawking once pointed out that there will be no time travel in the future, ever. And the reason he knows that is because if there were, we would be inundated with tourists from the future. Now, I find that delightful. It's an elegant thought experiment.
Yeah, I've heard that before too. It's very, it's also a nice chuckle.
Yeah, it is a nice chuckle. He's a funny guy. So I would riff off of that and say, it isn't possible to go into a psychic to a a subjective state that you might think of as a psychic power, and travel and glean information that is going to be useful to us in our ordinary waking reality. It isn't going to be possible. It isn't possible to do that reliably. And why do I say that? Because if it were, somebody, and it would be the same person every year, would win the World Series of Poker every year. All you have to do is go into your travel and go around behind that person and look at her cards, and you got this.
Got it. That's nice. Yeah, it's interesting. I've always had this kind of appreciative skepticism about subtle energy and psychic phenomena along those lines. That there is some reality to this, but its reliability and, you know, it just doesn't have the same status of knowledge as objective knowledge. It has a subjective element and always will.
Yes, and I think we go too far if we say that because I have this very clear and profound subjective experience of these other realms, they inherently exist in some objective way, and they're just kind of sitting there waiting for people like me to visit. I don't have any reason to believe that. For me, that would be a violation of Occam's razor. Keep it simple. What I know for sure is that I had that experience.
Yeah, very good. You know, I think asked follow-on questions that are really useful, but I'm losing the time to ask some excellent questions that have come in. Let me ask just one more and hold you a little longer, if that's all right.
Sure.
Just to give us a chance to go a little further. Ari in Tucson asks, people sharing with each other what the other is missing seems to me to presuppose an objective reality or wholeness that informs what the missing pieces are. Otherwise, how can we know for certain what piece is missing? I think she's maybe trying to out you. It's having some kind of implicit metaphysical assumption that's not so strictly empirical.
Okay, well, if he or she can, I would be grateful for being shown something that I'm not seeing. At the moment, though, what I would say is that just as if you're standing in the kitchen and I'm standing in the living room, I can see behind you to the cabinets that you can't see, and you can see behind me out the windows to the giant stadium across the street. I don't think that I don't see it. I don't see how that presupposes anything other than points of view.
Mm. Very good. I'm going to indulge myself, since you answered that so concisely, to give you another question from Debbie in the UK. She asks, do you have to be reasonably adept at first gear to be able to transcend the who of your prevailing filter in second gear, either subjectively or intersubjectively? And then, in your experience, is the experience of the third gear a kind of co-arising of all three gears, a wholeness with no subject, which then gives way to noticing and transcending, etc.? Or have I not understood this fully?
Generally, yes, to the part about third gear. And as for, does a person need to be adept at first gear in order to do these other things that we're talking about? Probably. I don't know, but I think that this ability to objectify one's experience is so basic, it's so fundamental to what we're talking about, that without that, well, for one thing, without that, second gear wouldn't be possible, because you can see that it's who am I question as a subset of first gear. Because when I ask who am I, what am I, I'm turning attention back toward some sense of subject. Is there any sense of subject here? If I find that there is, and we often do, there actually is a reason, there are reasons why we think we're in here. Those are objects. Those become objects. So second gear can become, or second gear can be thought of very rightly as a subset of first gear. Is first gear requisite? I think so. Now, if you were to just sit and have a non-dual experience all the time, which I think some people would advocate, although I would not, it's not entirely clear to me how that's different from the experience of a dog or a frog. And I think to experience what it's like to be a dog is wonderful for a human to be able to do. Is it the apotheosis of human experience? I don't think so. I mean, there's so many things that we can do in dualistic mode that I consider to be really valuable. I just
Excellent.
Wouldn't privilege one over the other. And,
yeah.
and I should also, I just want to give a nod to people who are going to say, oh, Kenneth, that's because you have no idea what non-dual experience is. In fact, non-dual experience is so special, magical or mystical that it trumps everything out else. So I would just say, yes, I believe I do have a great deal of experience with what non-dual experience is. And a lot of training in that regard. And I think there's something you're not seeing if you believe that non-dual experience is that it should be ontologically privileged as the truth with a capital T or reality with a capital R. Because what's in fact happening, in my opinion, is that you're having an exquisitely subtle and wonderful experience that is still an experience. Now, whether you perceive that there's somebody there to have it is really beside the point. At a certain point of development, I will argue, and now I'm really going to anger some people, you will be able to see that there is no basis for privileging that.
We don't have a lot of time. I feel kind of honor-bound to presence the fact that I've been in the presence of profound non-dual realizers whose very presence has seemed to function as with a tremendous amount of power. The city or the field or the transmission was so strong that it drew me into a profoundly different state, and that the force of that was so strong on me and others that it seemed undeniable. And somehow it feels important to mention that counts for something, that it's not only evaluatable subjectively if it has those kinds of effects on others.
Nice. Okay, I agree. There is some people are able to manifest a remarkable field that other people can feel, and I think it's undeniable. It may even be useful. I would probably see it as a double-edged sword, because it's just so easy to abuse that kind of power, and it is often done. It may be that humans are not well equipped to handle that kind of power if they have this siddhi, as you say, this psychic power of Shaktipat, or this energy that other people can feel. In some ways, you would think that the people feeling it are benefiting, and they will often say that I've benefited tremendously from that. Good luck, bad luck, good news, bad news, who knows. I personally lately have shied away from deliberately manifesting anything like that, because I think ultimately it's not as helpful as some other ways of communicating.
In that there's a potential diluting power and all kinds of okay. Well, Kenneth, we could go on forever, and we've gone on a little long already, so I want to bring this to a dignified close before I indulge myself and all of us any further. But thank you so much for joining us. A few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Kenneth, please go to kennethfolkdharma.com, KennethFolkdharma.com. And you're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my newsletter or to inquire about working with me personally. Thank you so much, Kenneth, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Terry. It's delightful talking with you. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Goodbye.